Done? We'll go from there.
So you're saying,
Hayden bites out,
that we could both put a month of work into this and you might not even decide to do the book?
I'm surprised by how blunt he's being, bordering on combative, but the gleam returns to Margaret's eye and the corners of her naturally pink lips turn up.
That's the deal.
For the first time since I sat down, his eyes flash to me.
All right,
is all he says. Not a word more, but somehow his tone makes it evident what he means. Not, all right, I understand, or all right, I'll consider it, but all right, I'm in. Margaret's smile widens as she spins toward me.
Miss Alice, what do you think?
I think it through, ask myself whether there's any reason not to stick around a few weeks and shoot my shot. Who am I kidding? I would have said yes even if she wasn't paying. I would have drained my savings and put my job at the scratch on the line and stood on my head while doing the YMCA with my legs if she asked. I would have done just about anything for this opportunity. I'm in, I tell her. She claps her hands together.
Wonderful. This calls for a toast.
She hefts her martini glass into the air. Hayden, visibly skeptical, lifts his rocks glass to join her, and right as I'm about to point out that I don't have a drink yet, Jody drifts out of the shadows to set a tray down on the table. A silver coffee pot, a steaming mug, a saucer of creamer, and a little white bowl of brown sugar cubes, and next to it, a stack of tabbed documents. Contracts. I take my mug and lightly clink it against Margaret's and Hayden's cups. Margaret lets out a refreshed sigh after she sips.
Now, she says, who's hungry?
After dessert, lemon meringue pie, Margaret is the one to walk Hayden and me back through the house to the front door. Only a couple of lamps are still on, and there's no sign of Jody, lending a bit more credence to my theory that she's on the clock when she's at Margaret's.
Now, you've both got your paperwork?
She double checks as she opens the door for us.
Yep.
I brandish the folder she gave me, and Hayden simply nods. He barely spoke at dinner either, just sort of glowered at whatever he was eating. I don't know if it was my presence or if this is how he always is, but it's hard to imagine a man like this coaxing Len Sterling's breathtaking, heart-squeezing story out of him, let alone finessing it into the beautiful version I read. Then again, I know better than most that you can rarely tell who a person really is or what they're going through just from looking at the surface of things. For all I know, Hayden came straight to dinner from getting unwelcome personal news or arrived on Little Crescent straight off a breakup. In my experience, it's best to give people the benefit of the doubt.
And your pie?
Margaret asks. Now, both Hayden and I lift our little Tupperware containers of leftover fluffy meringue in confirmation.
Well then, she says with a wink, my people will be in touch.
I can't wait, I tell her, going in for a hug before I can think better of it. Luckily, she reciprocates with a tight squeeze across my back.
More to come, more to come,
she promises, then turns with her arms wide to hug Hayden, only he's already lifted his hand to shake hers. She laughs a little, but takes it warmly between both palms.
You two get home safe, she says.
Then, where are you staying?
The Grand Lucia, I say.
Hayden's eyes cut sideways toward mine, his mouth twisting down for a brief moment before he faces Margaret again.
Grand Lucia,
he bites out.
Oh, good, she says. Glad you won't be far from a friend if you need one.
I flash Hayden a smile. He doesn't look over. Anyway, I say brightly, we'll get out of your hair.
And you get that paperwork back to me so we can get started.
She ushers us through the front door and waves as we make our way down the path toward the road, so I wave over my shoulder every few feet or so, a game of Southern hospitality chicken, both of us waiting to see who cracks first. Hayden, meanwhile, is stalking ahead, eyes on the prize being getting the hell away from me, apparently. I throw one last wave over my shoulder as I follow the bend in the path that leads to the gate.
Hayden has left it open for me, and I hurry after him to the quiet, moonlit country road beyond.
So, I say, should we talk schedule?
Schedule?
He doesn't slow his pace. I jog to catch up with him by our cars, his parked in front of mine.
I was thinking we could divvy the days up, so you work with her Monday through Wednesday, and I take Thursday to Saturday.
He stops and faces me so suddenly I nearly collide with his chest. Instead, I screech to a halt close enough that I have to tip my head up to meet his eyes.
Then you would get the weekend, and I'd only get weekdays.
Okay, I say. Then I'll take Monday through Wednesday, and you take Thursday through Saturday.
Then you only have weekdays,
he points out. I laugh. That's a problem for you?
I assume you're still writing for the scratch, and I'll need time for my freelance work. We'll both need some weekdays free,
he says.
Plus, to get a full picture of a subject, you'll need a more complete view of her schedule.
I feel my brow inch up toward my bangs.
So, what, you're looking out for me? Instead of just taking the upper hand?
Just more proof that there's always more to people than what you see first. He rolls his eyes and turns away from me, stalking toward his car.
Trust me,
he calls as he pauses to unlock his car door, nothing but a huge shadow against the moonlight.
I don't need an upper hand.
5. Despite being in his car, with the door shut, headlights on, and engine purring, Hayden doesn't speed away until I'm in my car with the door locked. Maybe he actively doesn't want me to get murdered on a dark country road out by the marsh, or maybe it's just coincidence, but I'm choosing to be positive. He can't be as bad as he seems, and even if he is, it's not like we'll be spending time together. I roll my windows down and pull away from Margaret's house, listening to the soothing hum and murmur of a Georgia night. Briefly, I consider calling my mom to let her know the news, but it's after 10 and she's always been an early bird. Besides, it's probably best to wait until I see how things shake out. I'll let her know I'm close by for work, schedule a time to visit her, but wait to divulge anything else until I know which way the scales are tipping. I glide back onto the mostly empty four-lane road that connects the mainland to Little Crescent and slow to a stop at a red light. Hayden's in the next car over. He notices me, too. I wave. He frowns. The light turns green, and we both pull through. It feels like we're both trying to not drive side by side, but the stoplights keep foiling us. We pass Little Croissant and the other shops, and I get into the lane behind him so at least we aren't taking turns passing each other anymore. At the Main Street intersection, I follow him through a right turn back toward Tourist Town and into the parking lot of the Grand Lucia Resort. He turns left down an aisle, so I turn right. In the end, we wind up parking 3 spaces apart. He takes the same staircase that I've been taking to and from my room. I slow my pace, but surprisingly, he pauses halfway up the first set of steps when he realizes I'm behind him. Not only does he pause, he actually turns toward me and makes eye contact. Huge progress for us. Friendship bracelets incoming, surely.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday,
he grunts. Good days, I say.
Or, he says, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. You choose which you want. You'll be able to spend Friday or Saturday evening with her that way, if you want, and we'll either alternate Sundays or take them off, depending on what she prefers.
I stop on the same step as him, considering the plan. When would we start?
I plan to get all of this,
he lifts the paperwork,
wrapped up tomorrow. Friday and Saturday can be our first research days.
How did you find her? I ask. His brow knits at the question.
I'm not telling you that.
Really? I ask. Why?
Because you don't need to know,
he says. I'll tell you how I found her, I say, dangling the offer like a carrot.
I'm not interested.
He resumes climbing, and I follow. We reach the first floor landing and both keep going.
You're already here, I point out. Knowing how I got here doesn't do you any good, just like you telling me how you found out about Margaret wouldn't give me any kind of edge.
I really don't see why you care,
he says. I'm curious, I say. It wasn't easy figuring this out. He casts me a suspicious sidelong glance as we reach the second landing.
So you're impressed, he says dryly.
I ask, is that so hard for you to believe? He snorts and goes back to staring straight ahead as we climb.
You're doing it again,
he grumbles without looking over at me. What? I ask.
The maniacal smiling,
he says. That surprises a laugh out of me. I'm not sure how you can tell. You're not even looking at me. That earns me a dart of his eyes to mine.
And yet I see now I was right.
It's just exciting, I say.
This breakneck race up the stairs?
He deadpans. Working with Margaret, I reply. You have to be a little excited, somewhere inside that block of marble.
I wouldn't call not getting a job exciting to me, personally, no.
He grumbles. But you're in the running, I say.
Yes, he says. And so are you.
Right, I say. That's the excitement. Can you imagine the stories she has to tell? She's met everyone. She's been everywhere. This is the job of a lifetime.
I'm aware of that, he says. Thus my irritation at being strung along for a month before even finding out whether I have it.
We reach the third of four floors, and he hesitates a moment, waiting to see which way I'm going. I step off the landing onto the walkway. With a sigh, he follows. What are the odds? I say as we fall into step side by side. He doesn't seem amused. That's okay. I'm amused enough for the both of us. He pauses at one of the pale blue doors, something like relief seeping into his bold features.
This is me,
he says. Ah, I say, walking past him to the very next door. My room.
You're kidding,
he says. I'm not, I say. Sorry in advance, I've been told I snore. He shakes his head, muttering to himself.
Of course you do.
As he fishes his room key out of his back pocket. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, I say. His eyes slice back to me, his hand stilling on the doorknob. If it really doesn't matter to you, I begin, I'll take Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. He looks at me silently for another moment, then gives one slow nod.
In case I don't see you again, then...
It was nice meeting me, I guess. The corners of his mouth twitch downward.
Enjoy your stay, Alice,
he corrects me. It's the first time he said my name, and for some reason, it feels like a win. As he steps into his room, I can't help but call out, Sweet dreams, Hayden! Use a white noise app! His only reply, as the door swings shut, is a grunt. Or maybe, surely it wasn't a laugh. I unlock my door and go inside, ready to scour my list of furnished rentals. For Hayden Anderson's sake, I'll shift my search far away from the Grand Lucia Resort. At least, as far as you can reasonably go on a 6-square-mile island. I sleep badly and wake up early. It's dark out, but I can't seem to grab hold of the tail end of sleep as it escapes from me, so I might as well get up and fill my body with coffee. I pull on shorts and a tank top, then grab my laptop bag and step out into the blue morning, my arms and legs prickling from the sea breeze. The roads aren't as empty as they were last night. There are locals heading into work and tourists driving down to stake their claim at the beach before things get too hectic, but the world feels quiet and still. And when I pull into the little enclave of shops back toward the mainland and Margaret Street, the lot is sparsely populated. Most of the shops on the left are shut tight. All the restaurants on the right, aside from Little Croissant, also sit dark and empty, the striped umbrellas over the patio tables snapped closed. There's only one customer in front of me, a man with a horseshoe pattern of white hair around an otherwise bald head. The back of his salmon pink t-shirt reads, I got my sea legs at Fishbowl, Little Crescent Island, complete with the street address in smaller font just below it. Captain Cecil? I say, recognition hitting me. The older gentleman turns around, revealing a gap-toothed smile.
Well, hi there.
I'm glad I ran into you, I tell him. I wanted to thank you for the drink the other night.
Pretty tasty, huh?
He asks. Extremely, I agree. The barista waves the good captain up to the window to order, but I head him off. Let me get this for you. His wispy, curly gray brows pinch together.
Now, why on earth would I do that?
To make a visitor very happy, I say. He chuckles.
Well, can't rightly argue with that.
I should hope not. He steps up to order.
One large iced brown sugar and cinnamon latte with whipped cream on top, please.
The barista nods and scribbles cabin on one of the to-go cups before turning to me. Same thing, I say, but no whipped cream, please.
I'll take hers, Cecil puts in.
Oh, and a large iced green tea, I add on a whim.
You got it,
the barista tells us, and I hand my card over to pay, punching the tip into the tablet when he swivels it toward me.
So,
Cecil says as I step back to join him,
what's a gal like you doing flying solo on our little island?
I'm here for work, I tell him. He frowns at this.
Work? This is the wrong place for that.
Well, I love my work, I say. So it's also kind of for pleasure.
And what is it you do?
He asks. Then,
actually, who is it you are? You seem to know my name, but I don't recall yours.
Oh, Sherry told me who you were, I say, holding my hand out to shake his. I'm Alice, and I'm a writer.
Charmed to meet you, Alice the writer,
he says, pumping my arm twice before dropping my hand. Same to you, I agree.
And what is it that you write? Is our fine home to be the locale for a murder mystery?
He seems delighted by the thought. No, no, at least not one written by me. I'm a journalist. He whistles through his two front teeth.
How about that? An article about Little Crescent. Finally getting our due.
I don't correct him. I gave the NDA a quick read last night before sending it off to my lawyer, Reed, friend from college who is now a lawyer, and while I'm not confident I understand the full scope of it, I am fairly sure Margaret wouldn't appreciate having her presence on the island revealed before she's even agreed to do the book.
We had one once, you know,
he says.
Travel journalist from Rest and Relaxation. But frankly, she wrote more about her travel companion than she did about us.
Two iced brown sugar cinnamon lattes,
another barista calls from the next window over.
One iced green tea.
Cecil and I step up to collect our respective drinks.
You extra thirsty?
He asks, eyeing the tea.
Or are you meeting someone?
Meeting someone, I say. Then add, maybe. I'm not sure. If Hayden happens to run past again, I'll give it to him. If not, I'll drop it by his room after. Cecil frowns.
Alice, if you have to wonder whether he'll show, he's not worth it. That's my two cents, now that you asked.
I feel myself smiling. He's way older than my dad was, but there's still something in this man that reminds me of my father. The confident but relaxed posture, or the barrel chest. I appreciate the little ache that sends through my throat, the reminder of how lucky I was to have my family, how lucky I've always been. I'll definitely keep that in mind.
Well, I'm afraid I've got a long day ahead of me,
Cecil says, fishing his wallet out of his pocket.
But if you need anything while you're around, here's my info.
He tucks a business card between my fingers and the cup of coffee. Thanks. I really appreciate that, I tell him. He waves me off as he heads toward the steps down to the dirt drive.
And Alice?
He shouts over his shoulder.
Yeah?
Don't wait too long.
He juts his chin meaningfully toward the green tea. I lift it in salute to the captain, and he chuckles as he shuffles off. I carry both cups down to the stone patio off the side of the platform, setting them on a wrought iron table nestled between a bunch of lush potted plants. A matching wrought iron gate rings the patio, ivy and kudzu crawling over it to give the space an enchanted feeling. A couple of women in workout gear chat over croissants at a table in the far corner, and once I set my laptop up, I go back to the window to order two myself. The coffee shop has decent Wi-Fi, so I pull up all of my bookmarked Margaret Ives sites, as well as my preliminary notes document, as I nibble on the pastry, dividing up the almond center bits so that each bite is the perfect ratio of buttery to sweet. Assuming my lawyer friend and my agent both give their approval in the next 2 days, I should be able to start interviewing Margaret by Saturday, and I want to be prepared. I also fire off an update to my group chat, Itchy Bitches, with my closest friends from the scratch. The last message was from Priya, last night, a blurry bar selfie, her raven hair twisted into a topknot, and a guy sitting behind her with the caption, "Does he look like Pedro Pascal? I've had 5 beers. The message came in after 2 a.m., and no one's replied, though both Bianca and Killian thumbs up to the picture in apparent approval. His face is barely visible, I point out, but I can tell he has a certain je ne sais quoi. Then, in a separate message, I add, "By the way, Em agreed to give me a shot. 1 month audition, basically." "Hell yeah," Bianca writes a few minutes later. "Though you should probably tell your editor." "Putting it in a formal email right now, Ms. Ribeiro," I write back, then pull up my inbox on my computer. I type bribeiro@thescratch.com into the to field to make my formal request. I'll still be working here, just mostly on stories that can be done remotely, by phone and email. Nothing too intensive. After I send the email, I go back to the group chat. "Unfortunately," I say, "there's another writer auditioning too. Hayden Anderson." Priya sends a picture of herself still in bed, squinting, last night's makeup blurred around her eyes. "Someone tell my editor I'm too sick to come into work today." "Should have thought of that before you sent the 5 beers text to her," Bianca points out. Killian replies to my text. "I've met him. Rather unpleasant sort, isn't he?" I frown. Rather unpleasant sort? Didn't realize I was texting a Regency-era gentleman. "What?" Killian says. "He is unpleasant. Hot, though. Sad." "I don't think he's that bad," I reply. "LOL," Killian replies. "Duh." "Meaning?" I say. "You like everyone," Priya says. I take a long sip of my latte. Once again, Cecil didn't steer me wrong. It's delicious. "I'm just saying," I type out. "He probably has his reasons for being the way he is. People usually do." Bianca and Killian both like the text, and Priya says, "Hot people are usually somewhat unpleasant. They don't have to play by the rules. Hotness is wasted on the hot. Like me." "As a pleasant hot person," Killian says, "I'm offended by this." "Putting you on Do Not Disturb to get some work done, but love you all." I silence my phone, put my head down, and pore over my notes, adding thoughts as I go. After about 30 minutes, though, my laptop battery is on its last legs. By then, the sun is all the way up, the back of my neck beginning to sweat and tingle with an oncoming burn, so I pack my stuff up and head back to the hotel. Late last night, I managed to book a place for the month, but it's not available until tomorrow, so I've got one more night at the Grand Lucia. And one more night as Hayden Anderson's neighbor, which I'm sure he'll be relieved to know. Rather than interrupt his morning by knocking on his door, I leave his green tea and the paper bag with his croissant outside his door, then let myself into my own room. I plug my computer in to charge, then take a scorching shower, mostly because my bangs are too greasy for dry shampoo to have any shot. Afterward, I towel dry my hair, my bangs falling into messy pieces across my forehead, and slather myself in sunscreen before getting dressed. Since this is, ostensibly, one of my last free days before I dive into work, I decide I might as well do something fun, like go to the beach or rent a bike and ride around the island. I put on my bathing suit, just in case, and pull on a floral yellow and pink romper with a 60s-style collar, along with the Simon Miller platform sandals Priya gave me for my birthday. If my mom could see this outfit, she'd faint. When I was a teenager, she'd insisted that because I was tall, everything looked shorter on me than on other girls, and while she was very likely right, I'd always so desperately wanted to be allowed to dress like the other girls I went to school with, which is probably why I still style myself, in Bianca's words, like a little scamp, or as Killian put it, like a 1990s animated Nickelodeon teenager. Both compliments, in my opinion. I leave my laptop behind, but slide my notepad into my bag, along with my sunglasses, before stepping out onto the walkway. I'm already past Hayden's door when I notice the green tea and croissant still sitting there. I backtrack, check the time on my phone. Surely he's up by now. For a second, anxiety spikes through me. I check the long dormant impulse to panic. For the most part, I'm grateful for the things my childhood gave me, optimism, empathy, and appreciation for life, but the unease that still comes from a shut door isn't one of them. The urgent ping of, did something happen? And the thought that always follows, what if I'm too late this time? I shake myself. Hayden is not my sister. I have no reason to suspect he might not be okay, and furthermore, no reason to feel responsible for his well-being. Still, I find myself knocking on his door, needing to be sure he's all right. When there's no immediate reply, the anxiety deepens. Never mind that he could be out running, or at lunch, or anywhere else on the island. I just have a feeling he's the sort to stick to the same basic schedule every day, and if that's the case, he should have been back from his run by now. I pound again. Hayden? I shout. I hear a muffled grunt from deep within the room, and instantly something in me relaxes. I mean, for all I know, he's duct taped to a chair inside, but that sounded like a fairly typical Hayden grunt from what I've witnessed so far.
Grunt twice if you're okay,
I shout. Instead, I hear the rattle of the deadbolt, and then the door swings open.
Is there a fire? He asks.
I can't answer immediately. I'm focused on prying my eyes off the bare expanse of chest at face level to look up into Hayden Anderson's very nonplussed expression. 6. I swallow the lump of heat that's risen to the back of my throat. Now that I know he's fine, I'm embarrassed. Now that I see he clearly responded to my pounding by running straight from the shower to the front door, a towel wrapped around his waist and a scowl set deep into his brow and jaw, I'm humiliated. My whole body feels hot and tingly, that burgeoning sunburn feeling times 100.
Alice?
His expression wavers.
Is everything okay?
I step back abruptly from him and bend to grab the tea and croissant off the ground, holding them out at arm's length.
Didn't you see these when you got back from your run?
His gaze dips, then rebounds to my face.
Yes.
I balk. Then why didn't you take them?
Because I didn't know where they came from, he says, and I'm not in the habit of eating and drinking things I find on the ground.
I feel myself wilting.
I brought them for you.
His dark brows flick upward, the light catching his eyes for a second, turning his irises the color of whipped coffee. Despite the latte sitting in my stomach, it sends a burst of thirst across my tongue. He clears his throat.
I didn't realize.
He reaches out one hand to accept the cup and bag from me, his other still clutching the towel against his damp hip, which, of their own accord, my eyes drop to before snapping back to his face.
Thank you,
he says.
No problem,
I force out, keeping my eyes pointedly not on his water-speckled chest, or the rivulets running from the dark hair tucked behind his ears down his neck, or his stomach and hips and legs and towel and whatever's under the towel. And
anyway, today's our last day as neighbors. I booked my rental for the month.
He opens his mouth as if to say something, then closes it on a nod.
Sorry again if my snoring kept you up,
I say. He hesitates before answering.
It was actually sort of soothing.
I guffaw.
Are you serious? You could hear it through the wall?
He lifts one shoulder, my eye tracking the motion, my body impolitely informing me that I might have a shoulder fetish.
I'm a light sleeper,
he says.
Don't take it personally.
Oh, I try to take almost nothing personally, I tell him. I actually could probably afford to take a little more personally.
The corners of his mouth twitch, and I have no idea whether it's a gesture toward a smile or a grimace. I take a half step back.
Anyway, in case I don't see you again.
It was nice meeting me,
he says, parroting my words from last night, with one brow hooking upward. I break into a grin. Enjoy your stay. As I walk away, his low thunder roll of a voice says,
Nice meeting you too, Alice.
That, I decide, is definitely a win. That night, I awake to a screech, to flashing lights, to sheer confusion. I jolt away from the sound and half tumble out of bed, bleary eyes darting around the dark room. On the wall behind the bed, a mounted device flashes and blares, alternating strobes of red and white streaking across the room. My first thought is ambulance. My second is Audrey, my sister. Pain spears through my chest right alongside the panic, and then I piece my surroundings together. Fire alarm, I realize. You wouldn't think that would trigger such a wave of relief in me, but it does. My chest loosens, my heart very gradually slowing as I clamber to my feet and snatch my laptop and phone from the side table on my way to the door. I step into my sandals, grab my room key, and dart out onto the walkway, joining the crowd of sleepy kids and grumpy adults stumbling toward the stairs. The night is sticky and warm as we make our way down to the parking lot, hotel staff spilling out from the lobby, a manager shouting for us to remain calm! The fire department will be here shortly! I join a group of guests standing on the sidewalk. With my laptop tucked under my arm, I check the time on my phone, just before 4 a.m. Someone stumbles into me, and I look up to find a man about 10 or 15 years older than I am, swaying on the spot, his red-rimmed eyes fixed dully on me. I reach out to steady him. Are you okay? His toothy grin blasts me with the smell of liquor. He's drunk, not simply tired.
Better now, baby.
His gaze drips down me like slime. I'm wearing a blue nightgown from the 60s, loose and long enough to cover my knees, but he manages to make me feel like I'm naked, and not in a good way. I try to step back, but he's latched onto my elbow now. He seems more solid, steady, than I first thought.
I think we might be neighbors, he says, squinting at me. What room are you in?
I look uncertainly over my shoulder, hoping for a friendly face or even just proof that there's anyone else watching, but no one's looking this way. I don't remember. His expression darkens, the smile melting off his face.
You don't remember? There you are,
says a low, cool voice behind me. I spin around, the drunk man's grip loosening on my arm, but not entirely letting go. Hayden towers over me, his face stony. Hi! I try to signal with my eyes what's going on. I'm not sure whether it's working because Hayden's face remains exactly the same. He turns toward the interloper as he asks,
Who's your friend?
He's our neighbor, I guess, I say.
I thought you were here alone,
the man says, either too drunk or too clueless to realize how horrifying that is to hear as a woman who is, in fact, frequently traveling alone. I open my mouth to try to excuse Hayden and me from the conversation, but Hayden's faster.
Nope.
He curls an arm loosely around my waist.
Not alone.
The man's face slackens, his hand finally sliding off my arm.
You should have said so.
He slurs at me irritably. Yes, I'm the one at fault here. I shrug, like, what are you gonna do?
If you'll excuse us,
Hayden says,
I think we'll take this break from our room as a chance to go get breakfast.
The man swats an annoyed hand in our direction as Hayden turns and steers me deeper into the parking lot, his arm falling away. Thank you, I say. I'm really bad at that. His gaze lances over his shoulder at me.
Bad at what?
Avoiding drunk people, I say. Avoiding creepy people, not starting conversations with strangers, getting out of conversations with strangers, you name it. The corners of his mouth tighten. He stops beside the passenger door of his rental car. I look back the way we came and find our inebriated friend leaned at a nearly 45-degree angle against a tree. If we give it 5 minutes, he'll be asleep, and we can go back and wait with everyone else, I say. Hayden's frown deepens. I mean, not that you have to stay with me, I add. Honestly, now that I know his whole deal, I'm fine. I just won't engage again. I know we already said our farewells this morning, so... His head tilts like he's puzzling over something.
I was serious about going to get breakfast, if you want to join.
It's 4 a.m., I point out.
These things always take forever, even when they're false alarms, he says. We'll be out here at least another hour. Might as well go somewhere more comfortable.
But it's 4 a.m., I repeat.
So you're not hungry?
I'm famished, I say, but nothing will be open. He turns and unlocks the passenger door.
Something, he says, is always open.
Hayden punches Ray's Diner into his GPS once we're settled in the car. It's 25 minutes away, back on the mainland.
Maybe I should have mentioned, he says. The something that's open is towards Savannah. Closest thing I could find. That a problem?
I shrug. Not for me. Like you said, these things always take forever anyway. But if you wanted to go back to sleep...
I can never go back to sleep once I get up,
he tells me, starting the car.
Thus why I know about Ray's Diner.
When we get there, a few trucks and cars are already littered throughout the lot. Bells tinkle over the door as we let ourselves in. A server in a mint green dress and apron is mopping between the tables, and oldies play quietly over the crackly speakers. A grizzly bearded man looks over at us, noticing that we're in pajamas. Or rather, I am. Hayden's in black sweats and a white t-shirt, so he's more discreet, but then goes back to eating his eggs. The server looks up from mopping as we pass and nods a greeting.
Be right with you,
she promises, and we settle into the corner booth. You're a real corner booth guy, I say. His brows pinch.
What?
You took the corner booth at Fishbowl, too.
The corner booth is objectively the best booth.
Says who? I ask. He shrugs.
I don't know. No one needs to say it. It's obvious.
I gesture toward the other few diners, most of them likely long haulers or people getting off third shift. None of them chose this booth.
It was probably occupied when they got here,
he says, unfolding one large plasticky menu and sliding another across the Formica tabletop toward me. How many times have you been here since you got to town? I ask.
4,
he says, not missing a beat.
Counting today.
And how many of those times have you scored this booth? I ask. His eyes slowly peel up from the menu to meet mine.
You're doing it again.
Doing what?
Smiling like you've just walked into a surprise birthday party,
he says,
when almost nothing is happening.
Something is happening, I counter. I'm getting to know your idiosyncrasies.
My idiosyncrasies?
He scoffs a little, sets the menu down.
You're the one who sleeps in an I Dream of Genie costume.
I devolve into laughter at that. The server sidles up, her notepad ready and waiting.
Get you anything to drink?
Coffee,
he says, then looks to me. Me too.
What about food? You ready to order?
She asks us. Hayden tosses another quick look my way. I can be, I promise, flipping open the proportionally gigantic menu.
Egg whites, wheat toast, and the seasonal fruit, please,
he tells her, and her large brown eyes swivel to me next. Peaches and cream French toast, I tell her.
Have that right out for you.
She walks away.
Did you notice she never starts speaking at the beginning of the sentence?
He asks, ducking his head and dropping his voice. I mirror his posture. How many times did you get the corner booth, Hayden? His lips twitch downward.
If you want to move tables.
Oh, I don't want to move tables, I say. I'm just fascinated by the way you see the world. He leans back against the shiny pink banquette.
It's the most protected seat in the house. You have a view of every entrance and exit.
You're by the toilets, I add.
You can see the server anywhere in the restaurant if you need to flag them down.
You're by the toilets, I say.
Or alternately, if I sat where you're sitting, no one would be able to see my face without trying pretty hard,
he says. You're by the toilets, I say. And also, are you on the run?
I'm private,
he says. And I'm the one with the idiosyncrasies, I tease. One of his brows arches upward. He opens his mouth to retort, then shuts it again as our server reappears, flipping our mugs right side up and filling them from the steaming pot in her hand.
Thank you,
Hayden says stiffly.
It's no problem at all, sweetie.
She retreats again, pausing at the counter to top off the bearded man's mug. Hayden hesitates, considering something for a while, and I fight every impulse to rush him. He really does remind me of some huge, wild animal, not dangerous, but skittish.
I grew up in a sort of public family,
he settles on. Now I can't help it. I lean forward eagerly.
Please tell me the Andersons had a reality show.
He cracks a smile. At least I think it's a smile. It could also be a wince.
Not that public. My dad was the mayor.
The mayor, I repeat. The mayor of Indiana.
Well, since states don't have mayors, he says. No, but the mayor of a small town in Indiana, yeah.
I scoot to the edge of my seat, only to remember that our combined height makes such an arrangement inadvisable. Instead, I pull my legs up onto the bench and sit cross-legged, as far forward against the table as I can.
So you learn to be private from them?
No,
he says.
I learned to be perfect from them.
I must be making a face. Probably another, is this a surprise party just for me? Smile of delight, because what he's just said is so utterly ridiculous.
I didn't say I still do it,
he says. I stifle a laugh.
Oh, come on.
He scoots forward now, our knees knocking even with my adjusted posture.
I'm not so bad that you can't imagine me making a good impression.
I didn't say you were bad at all, I cry. But no one's perfect.
Oh, trust me,
he says.
My dad is, and my brother.
Is your brother the mayor now? I ask.
Worse,
Hayden tells me.
Louis is the local pediatrician, and his wife is the head of the school board.
Another cackle of delight escapes me.
Unless I joined the Peace Corps,
he says,
I was never going to live up to that.
Okay, well, one, I begin, holding up a finger. You won a fucking Pulitzer. I doubt they're wringing their hands over how to shepherd the Anderson family black sheep back onto the right path.
Maybe not now,
he allows.
But for the 10 years prior, yeah, I'm pretty sure they were.
And two, I cut in. That's pretty much a perfect segue into the fact that my sister actually, literally, is in the Peace Corps. He stares at me.
You're kidding.
Another round of exhausted giggles ripples through me. I'm not. She's like helping combat food shortages in another country right now, and I'm, to quote my mother, still doing that celeb gossip stuff. His forehead wrinkles.
But you don't write celebrity gossip.
Right, but what I do write is close enough that I can assure you my mother will never feel a pressing need to understand the difference. He shakes his head, evidently confused.
But she reads your work.
Inside my chest, it feels like a pinprick puncturing a balloon. No, not really. I mean, the first couple pieces when I got the job, yeah. But it's just not really her thing. And I get it. I mean, I'd actually probably prefer she not write it, rather than force herself to and then pretend badly that she liked it.
The Scratch is a prestigious outlet,
he says.
They pay well and have great subscription numbers.
I shrug. It's just not her thing. I get it. He studies me for a moment, so intensely that he, and frankly I, jump when our server returns to plop our plates in front of us.
Hot, so be careful,
she says, and then she's gone again. I clear my throat. So, I say, meeting Hayden's gaze once more. Are you excited for your first interview with Margaret? He shakes his head. You're not? I say.
No,
he says.
I mean, don't ask that.
Why not? I press.
Because I'm not going to talk about it with you,
he says. I roll my eyes, slide my feet back down to the floor, scooting forward again. My knees wind up caged in by his, but I don't retreat.
What do you possibly think I could steal from your answer to that question?
He stabs his fork into his eggs and leans in too, his thighs pressing gently against mine in the process. He drops his voice to match my tone.
Alice.
I feel a flutter of anticipation under my collarbone. Hayden, I say.
I'm not going to answer that either,
he says. Then he takes a huge bite. This round, I think, is a draw. 7.
I still can't really believe we're doing this, I say on Saturday morning. Sitting in a living room drinking mint tea,
Margaret teases, eyeing me through the steam lifting off the mug in her hands.
Alice, dear, I think you should aim higher.
She sits in the rattan chair across from the sofa where I'm perched, all the windows flung open and the smell of sun-warmed greenery drifting in toward us every time the wind blows, broken up by the occasional burst of brackishness from the marsh behind her property. Are you kidding? I say. This is my Everest. After this, I'll be ruined for celebrity profiles. I'll have to retire early, or like, get really into fixing up old cars or something. I honestly didn't think you'd agree to this.
Then why'd you go to all the work of tracking me down?
She asks.
I shrug. I had to try, at least.
She gently sets her mug on the glass-topped table between us, a curious gleam in her blue eyes.
Do you remember what you said in that last voicemail you left me before I finally called you back?
I shake my head. I'd called so many dozens of artists selling work on small islands in Georgia before a post on the not-so-dead celebrities message board pointed me to Little Crescent, and plenty more, even once I'd homed in on the right island. They'd all denied being Margaret Ives, which I figured couldn't exactly rule them out, but she was the first to hang up as soon as the question was out of my mouth. I hadn't called her back for a week. I'd been too afraid she'd block me right away. When I finally did, she sent my call to voicemail, and I left a short message explaining who I was and why I wanted to talk to her. I made myself wait 3 more days, and then I took one last swing, another voicemail, this one more an impassioned pitch than a question, because at that point, I was already 60% convinced I'd found the right person. She'd called me back 9 days later, and I'd almost thrown my phone out the window of the cab I was in, trying to answer it as fast as possible. Honestly, it's a blur, I say. She says,
you told me you cried when you heard that Cosmo had died.
My face burns. Did I really? God, I'm so sorry. That was inappropriate. She cracks a smile.
Inappropriate? I didn't think so. Curious? Exceptionally, seeing as how my husband had to have passed away at least 30 years before you were even born.
I set my mug aside. Yeah, but I only found out right around my 7th birthday. My dad was a big music guy. He always used to listen to Cosmo Sinclair when we were making dinner. Hearts on Fire was my favorite.
A great album, Margaret says proudly.
When I turned 7, my parents let me have a birthday party. But my sister and I were homeschooled back then and didn't have many friends. So when my mom asked me who I wanted to invite, I said, Cosmo Sinclair. And my parents, they just gave each other this look like, oh no. They never lied to me. That was their policy. So when they made that face, it usually meant they were about to tell me bad news. So that's how I found out. And I was so sad about it.
Sad that you'd never met him? Margaret says.
Sad for Peggy, I say. That was my favorite song on the album, Peggy All the Time. And I don't know, I just knew it had to be true. That you couldn't write a love song like that if you hadn't found a once-in-a-lifetime love. And I didn't want her to have lost the person who gave her that. Her gaze falls to her lap. I wonder if I should stop, if I'm pushing too early on something too sore. But she's the one who brought it up, and if I'm going to be a witness to her story, I want her to know that I understand. I clear my throat. My parents were both journalists, and all they really read was nonfiction, serious stuff about politics and climate change and sociology, stuff I had no interest in. But there was this one book my dad bought at a garage sale, an unauthorized biography. Her eyes slice up to mine, and I swear I see something behind them close up, shutting me out. I understand why, but I keep going anyway. The fall of the House of Ives. She stares at me, shoulders square, a pleasant and unconvincing smile hanging around her mouth. "You were my dad's dream interview subject," I explain. "He mostly did political stuff, and you'd already stopped doing interviews way before he started reporting, but he loved your story, yours and Cosmo's, from his songs, and he always felt like there was so much more to it than what the press wrote about it." Anyway, even before I could read, I loved looking at the pictures in that biography he bought. I loved all your clothes and your shoes and your hats. You were so glamorous, and my life had no glamour whatsoever. But it wasn't just that. You always looked not just happy, but like you were delighted by the world. The rest of your family, they looked so serious and secretive, but you were just you, bright and bold and full of life, especially in the photos with your sister and with Cosmo. And then when I got older, when I could read it, I hated that book. A quiet laugh leaps out of her, her gaze softening, no, glistening. Her blue eyes have dampened, her lashes inky and dramatic. A small laugh escapes me, too. Turns out my dad hated it, too. He just didn't want to tell me and ruin it. But there was nothing to ruin. It was all conjecture and judgment and recycled tabloid headlines. There was this one line in the chapter about your courthouse wedding where Dove Franklin wrote that a body language expert suggested you were marching Cosmo to his death, and he knew it. She says quietly. It wasn't just that they didn't believe he wanted to marry me. They also blamed me for what happened to him. My family's cursed, if you haven't heard. A shred of a heartbreaking smile flutters over her lips again. I'd been planning to paraphrase the quote rather than lob it at her like a grenade, but hearing her say it outright leaves me feeling like my chest has been pierced. I swallow hard. I looked at that picture, and I didn't understand how I could see something so different. Her jaw muscles flex, and after a long beat, she says, "And what did you see?" "I saw him trying to shield you," I say, "from everyone around you, and realizing he couldn't." She blinks several times, her gaze dropping to her lap again. For a moment, we're both silent. She clears her throat. "Sorry," I say softly. "I didn't plan to start with anything quite that heavy." "I asked," she replies with a fragment of a shrug. "You answered. That's how interviews work, as far as I remember."
"Yes, but I'm not the one being interviewed," I remind her.
A bit of wryness seeps back into her half-smile.
"Oh, I don't know. I think it's only fair that I get to know you and Hayden, too, if I'm going to be trotting out the family's map to all the buried bodies."
"And just to clarify," I say, "when you say buried bodies, are we talking literal or metaphorical here?" Her laugh is damp, but when she speaks, her voice is sure, clear, and bright again.
"Why not both?"
She leans forward over the table, where both my phone and my backup voice recorder are running, and enunciates clearly,
"Let the record show that I winked."
Which she does. I lean forward too.
"She did," I agree.
And then she dragged a finger across her throat like she was threatening me. Margaret hoots out a laugh as she sits back into her chair.
"So where were you thinking we'd start?"
"The beginning," I say. "I want to know what it was like to be born in Ives." She takes another sip of tea before returning her mug to its place on the table, right between my phone and my recorder.
"I'll be honest. When you told me you found me online, through those conspiracy theory websites, I figured you'd walk in here and kick off this interview with, Margaret, did you have Cosmo cryogenically frozen to be revived at a later date?
That is a popular one, I agree.
So Jody tells me, she replies.
You never go looking, I say, to see what people are saying?
She snorts. You obviously didn't grow up in a family like mine. The trick is to try not to see what they're saying.
I think it's safe to say no one grew up in a family like yours, I point out.
No, I suppose not.
Her eyes drift to where my bag sits at my ankles, and her head cocks, recognition writing itself across her face as she spots the book jutting out of it.
Can I see that?
I half expect her to start tearing pages out of it and ripping them to shreds, but if that will help her feel comfortable opening up, so be it. I pass The Fall of the House of Ives to her, and for several seconds she flips through it in silence, her expression stern, until finally a chortle leaps out of her, surprising me so badly that I jump in my chair. She shakes her head to herself.
It's funny. My family was one of the first to figure out that it isn't news that sells, it's headlines. Half the time, people don't read a word past those big splashy letters, and even if they do, the nuance isn't what they'll remember. It's the simple version that sticks. Simple and salacious, that's the winning combination.
Clickbait, I say, before the advent of clicking.
More or less, she agrees. That's what my family used to make themselves very rich, and like Dove Franklin says, powerful, too. But in the end, it doesn't matter. Even if you're the one to build the monster, you're never going to be able to control it. It'll gladly eat you alive and floss with your bones once it's finished with everyone else.
My chest squeezes as some of the crueler headlines I've read about Margaret and her family cycle through my mind. Her younger sister, Laura, had especially suffered at the hands of the press during her preteen years when she'd put on some weight and gotten an unfortunate haircut. Normal kid stuff that seemed so much worse when you juxtaposed her with her glamorous and austere family on red carpets and at ribbon cuttings and attending every other manner of highly publicized event. Margaret, on the other hand, had been the media's darling until she wasn't. It must have been strange, I say, growing up with all that attention on you. She almost smiles. It just barely reaches the corners of her lips, but goes not a millimeter further.
No one knows how normal or strange their own life is until they see the alternative. Life in the House of Ives was all I knew.
I must be making some kind of face, because one of her brows hooks sharply upward.
Whatever you're thinking, she says. You don't have to worry about breaking me, Alice. I'm hard to shake.
My chest pinches. Of course she is. No one person survives everything she did, plus years worth of public rehashing of those sad and bizarre events without getting some grit, I'm sure. Noted, I say. But I don't push her to begin even so. These interviews need to be a safe place for her. The only way to get a person's full, unfiltered story is to let them tell it to you when and how they want. The best stories are born when the words slip effortlessly from a subject's lips, rather than being painfully cranked out of them bit by bit. She sets the book on the table, her shoulders squaring as she meets my eyes.
Okay, Alice, let's start at the beginning.
And then she does. The story. Their version. Lawrence Richard Ives made the family filthy rich. He was also a cold-blooded sociopath who may have murdered his business partner. Her version. It's not that they were wrong exactly. It's just that they're answering the wrong question. Lawrence Richard Ives made the family rich. Who cares? That's not a story. It's an event. Even the how isn't all that interesting. And yet countless writers over the last century have cataloged that information again and again, like somehow it could add up to a full picture. The what? The eighth-born son of two destitute farmers in Dillon Springs, Pennsylvania, makes a fortune prospecting out west. The how? He spends every penny he makes on more land, more equipment, more smelting, more miners, more hotels in every soon-to-be-booming town along the trail of the so-called gold rush. The interesting question, the interesting answer, is almost always the why. That's why we read these celebrity tell-alls, isn't it? That's why we pore over cold cases. We want to understand why things happen. We want it all to make sense. The reason Lawrence Richard Ives got rich wasn't because of a knack for business. It was because he was hungry.